My name is Green, my eyes are green, and today we talk about playing on the green for the Golf Smarter episode number 170, March 17, 2009.
SmarterPodcasts.com, delivering sound advice.
The doctor will see you now, the putting doctor, Glenn Coombe.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome and thanks for downloading the St. Patrick's Day episode of the Golf Smarter podcast. I want to thank Sam Lyles of Jackson, Mississippi, who posted an enlightening discussion topic on our Golf Smarter Facebook group entitled Course Value. Sam wanted to know what you think is a reasonable price for a round of golf. He plays a Muni 18-hole course and pays $18 with a cart. He's paid $70 for a round at a very few nice courses and $35 for some very nice public courses. There are a number of responses, and I really want to see more people get in this conversation. So please join this and many more discussions we're having on the Golf Smarter group at Facebook.com. Now, the reason I'm so interested, these prices, I don't know if he's complaining or he's bragging about these prices, but I personally found some of the replies about what you pay absolutely fascinating because living in the bubble of Northern California, if we can get a weekend rate under $65, we call our friends to brag about the price, not our game. We don't have a lot of munis up here. I mean, cities don't run very many courses. And the one that I do play in San Francisco is Harding Park. And their weekend rate for residents of the Bay Area counties is about $100. San Francisco residents get lower rates, but forget $35. Even though Harding Park is hosting the President's Cup later this year, the city's politicians are not big fans of providing funds to a golf course when so many other agencies need help too. Now, I'm headed to play in Las Vegas during the same weekend as the NC2A college basketball tournament, and most courses are completely booked up at over $200 a round. Luckily, I've scammed a couple deals. Come on, that's why I do this. And because I could never pay that price and sleep at night. So please join our Facebook group and add to the conversation. Now, our guest today is Glenn Coombe, who bills himself as the putting doctor. He has a lot to share on putting, putters, and golf ball selection, so let's hear what he has to say. Welcome to the Golf Smarter Podcast, Glenn.
Well, thanks, Fred, for allowing me to be here with you today.
Well, it's a pleasure to have a putting doctor on because we love to talk about putting. We love to talk about golf balls. We love to talk about lowering our scores. And there is probably no better way to lower your scores than putting.
The fastest way to handicap improvement is through putting.
Well, they give you two of those. They give you two putts for every, on the scorecard right from the top.
If you could two-putt any green or have that mindset, how much lower would your handicap be?
But isn't the key trying to get to one putt? Occasionally, most of the time?
Let's think about playing within our means. Play according to our ability, and let's not set the bar too high. We want to be satisfied at the end of the round with our performance if we can be. If we set the bar too high, we start dealing in negatives. And if you're putting well, I think you'll agree that the rest of the game seems to follow. It's easier to hit that next tee shot if you rolled in a nice long putt, a one putt.
It changes the entire way you approach your next shot. There's no question about it. Conversely, you three putt, you four putt, it's going to change your next shot when you walk
up
to the tee box.
And that's why I say never leave a putt short.
Yeah.
How do we give every putt a chance to fall in the hole?
But there's something that you said to me while we were talking before the recording and started, and that was no fear.
Correct.
How do we get to that point?
Well, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Do you
only
have...
get one, though, by the way. I get to ask most of the questions. You get one. Go ahead.
Do you have a practice routine for putting? Do you do putting drills?
Yes, I do.
Well, you're a rare golfer amongst the majority of amateur golfers. Putting practice consists of chasing three balls around the putting green while waiting for the first tee to clear.
Mm-mm.
Average golfer arrives at the golf course ready to hit a bucket of balls on the driving range. The majority of those balls hit with the driver. And then immediately before teeing off, they warm up their putter, when in fact putting practice, in my book, should happen first. And the last warm-up shot you hit should be hit with your driver so that you're ready for the first tee. I hate going to the first tee with a hot putter because I'm not going to be using it for at least two more strokes.
At least. Especially in that first one. Now, it's interesting that I have, over the years, especially after doing all these conversations, I have changed my method of warm-up, we'll say with warm-up for now, that when I get to a golf course, if I only have time, and it's true, if I only have a short amount of time to warm up before I get to the first tee, I'll go to the putting green first. And then just go to the first tee instead of hitting balls. I'll take my warm-up swings and everything else, but I'll go to the putting green. If I do have time to hit a bucket of balls as well, I'll start with the putting green, hit my bucket
Marvelous.
Of balls, and then come back to the putting green one more time, just for the last
You are an exception amongst golfers. And certainly warming up to play is what prevents injury. And the golfer who goes out cold, number one, has no feel. Number two, isn't sure which game is showing up, be it his fade or his draw, or, of course, the dreaded straight shot. And when he gets to the first green, he has no clue how speedy, or shall we say lacking in speed, the green is today. I use the putting surface to, as I refer to it, sight in the speed of the green for that day. And because I play all over, I putt on a lot of different surfaces. And it can be sublime to the ridiculous in terms of stimp speed, what you're playing on today versus tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's, to me, the first thing that I want to figure out is not how true I'm hitting the ball, how straight I'm hitting the ball, but what is the speed? And hoping, you know, and I always ask in the pro shop, how consistent are your greens with your practice putting green? Hopefully they're going to try to keep those the same, right?
Well, you know, I hear this from a lot of amateurs who profess that the practice green is not as fast or not as slow as the 18 greens they play on. And I always find this a little hard to swallow because short of a little more foot traffic, the practice green is mowed with the same equipment that mows the rest of the fairway, or pardon me, the rest of the golf course.
Sure.
And the greens mower is not changed in height, but seasonally or for tournament play when the superintendent or the greens committee say we want them a little bit faster. You know, it may be in the transitional weather that a green is left to be a little bit longer, so it's a little more stable in, shall we say, cold or dry weather, trying to keep the grass alive. Superintendent may make some changes to mowing height, but throughout the industry, you will not find a greens mower working just the practice green. But again, everyone has an opinion, and some folks swear that the practice green is not the same pace as the rest of the greens. And I, again, I have a difficult time swallowing this. Well, basically, you have to warm up somewhere. You can't go to the first green and take three practice putts. Everything counts once you tee off.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, also, generally, a round of golf is going to take you, unfortunately, could take you more than 4 hours. But what, you know, temperatures may change. I mean, if you get there early in the morning and you're playing around and you're finishing off by noon, the atmospheric conditions are going to change, which are going to change the speed of the greens, aren't they?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. As the day heats up in some of the Southwest, certainly the greens will speed up, but they'll also grow. Mm. So depending, you know, there are so many variables, Fred, that the surface is what it is. Having an idea when you tee off, the speed of the green gives you an advantage over the player who does not know the speed of the green on the first green.
Can you give me a tip on how, for me, when I'm warming up, to measure the speed of the green so that I can take that with me to the first, second, third green and beyond?
How about your own personal stimp meter?
Yep. That's what I want to find.
Find a level area on the putting surface. And using the balls that you play with, not a range ball, let's putt three balls. And what we're going to do is we're going to keep our backstroke within our stance. So we're really, you know, we're kind of looking for, I'm guessing, a 8 to 10 foot putt pace. Putt three in a row and then walk them off. Once you get used to that length of stroke on a flat surface and you know what distance that generates on an average green or, say, your home course green, if you use that technique and find your ball coming shorter than normal or longer than normal, there's your stimp reading for today. If your normal course stimps at a 9 and you go out to a strange course and you use your personal stimp meter and you find that your ball is, you know, another pace and a half long compared to your home course, well, there's a very significant sign that the greens are rolling at 10, 11, 12.
Mm-hmm.
And that should have you wanting to do more putting practice prior to going out. But that's the first thing that we want to see. Mm-hmm. Because without knowing the speed of the surface, we can't estimate what break to play on a breaking putt.
Oh, I'm so glad you're saying this, because that has worked for me. And what I do is I'll take three balls on that flat surface, and without moving my head, without looking up, without even seeing where the balls are going, I'll take my, you know, what feels like a normal stroke for me. I'll hit those three balls, one right after the other, you know, pause for a moment, but try to stay right there. And then I'll walk those off. And generally, they're going to be around the same spot. And I'll walk those off. And that could range, my normal pace would probably be about 4.5, maybe 5 paces. But I've seen how it can range from 3.5 to 8 or 9 paces.
And your personal stimp meter.
And it really helps me through the day. It's amazing how
what you've done can work. Yes, what you've done is to sight in the speed of the surface for your play that day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm so glad we're going this direction, because I let the audience know that you were going to be coming on the show. I put it on the blog, which I do when we sign up interviews with people. I'll put information on the Golf Smarter blog so that people can go to a website or look at an article. I found an article that you had done and let them read that. And then they'll ask questions. And I do have some questions, if you don't mind, from the audience that I'd like to address with you. And the first one comes from Tad Dolbier, who's in Boone, North Carolina. Is that near you?
Yes, sir. And part of the favorite part of my territory that I travel on a regular basis. As a matter of fact, I did a putting clinic just outside of Boone last season at Jefferson Landing.
Okay, well, maybe that's where Tad plays. I'm not sure, but he may be looking for you soon. But he wanted to ask you about indoor putting practice. How can he get the most from those sessions on a carpet during the winter months?
Well, let's first of all talk about the carpet in use. There are a number of putting carpet manufacturers. The one I use is TrueLine, and it has a 9.8 to a 10 stimp rating, perfect pace for putting. If you're putting on a regular nap carpet, there are a lot of variables, how much cat hair is there and how new the carpet is. The accuracy of a manufactured carpet versus a true putting surface. We can practice bad habits, but the bottom line is that in the off season, if you can work on stroke mechanics, you're going to be very much further ahead come golf season than you would be if you're, shall we say, playing indoor tennis.
Sure, sure. I mean, I just have one of those inexpensive putting mats that have the slope on it, drops the ball and feeds it back, not with any power or anything. What, they're about 9 feet long. And yep. I feel if I can feel comfortable with that 9 foot putt, 8-9 foot putt, to me it's like shooting free throws all day. You know, when I'm on the phone, whatever it is, it's right here in my office. I feel a lot better when I get to the golf course. What I don't do enough, and I should, is put the ball at 3 and 4 feet. I'm always working on the length of this thing, but 3 and 4 feet, that's the one that I start shaking at when I'm out there on the course, as opposed to being as comfortable with that as I am on the longer ones.
There is a relatively inexpensive putting practice mat that I believe is called the Accelerator. And I have seen more people, I refer to it as the light coming on, but I've seen more people become advocates of what I teach as a stroke being short to long. I don't say accelerate forward because that can be a misnomer and lead to more trouble. But in a rhythmic stroke with a short to long pattern, it's amazing how much enthusiasm you can put behind the ball with a stroke that never gets outside of your stance. Mm. And I'm talking a normal, narrow shoulder-width stance. The idea of practice in the off season indoor should really be focused on routine and stroke mechanics and setup. If your setup is faulty and you practice, and you only practice one distance, basically you're ingraining a bad habit. So it's important to use some training aids, use a mirror, have a look at your setup, and as you said, vary the length of the putts that you practice.
Yeah.
Hopefully, the surface I work on, I'm able to build in a break or two by the use of the manufacturer supplied a thin and a thick hose, if you will, or pipe that can be laid under the putting surface. And it's quite remarkable how much you can make the carpet break. And that carpet is, I guess I've got about 12 feet of length. I work from 10 feet, and there's about 18 inches behind the cup. So I can actually work on my pet peeve that I try to drill into all of my students, and all of my students, when they leave me, have the ability to snap to attention and repeat after me. never leave a putt short.
Leave a putt short.
When I tap my ear toward the end of my 90-minute clinic, the crowd generally jumps to and says, never leave a putt short.
I guess it kind of leads into another question, and maybe we're being redundant here, but Walt Goshart, who is a member of the Business Golf Country Club group online, asked to ask you, what's a simple yet effective off-course or in-home 30-minute drill?
Well, Walt, you know, 30 minutes, golly, that's a great question. I think that indoor putting practice is probably best done in shorter stints. My lesson plan is full of information and reminders to stand up and walk around and stretch your back. One of the killers of putting practice has been the student who ends up in putting posture for 45 minutes and then has to go see his chiropractor.
Sorry, I don't mean
so
to
So everything... Yeah, I know why you're laughing.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, we're both laughing.
Everything in moderation. And to that end, if you have a area that you can set up for putting practice, I like to say to my students, set the money-back guarantee putting lesson mirror on the floor, your putter beside it against the wall, and every time you pass it, assume your setup position, do a two or three stroke waggle over the mirror, and put the putter back and go about your business.
Interesting.
What you're working on would be setup and stroke mechanics. You don't have to do that with a ball. There is no miss or make, satisfaction, dissatisfaction. What we're working on is to ingrain routine, proper posture, and a steady stroke.
Okay, and this all contributes to no fear.
10 foot tall and bulletproof. That's what I want all of my students to be. And that's where my lesson plan has had its success since 1993.
All right. Now, in the last 10 minutes or so that we have together, I really do want to get to a couple more of these questions that we've received from listeners. But you just talked about the ball. We haven't talked about the ball, and I have a lot of questions about the ball for putting, because everyone's talking about a ball for longer drives, more spin, blah, 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 blah. But I want to talk about a ball. But first, let me get you a question here that's from, let's go to this one here. This one's from Ron Mattson. He's in Camarillo, California. I'd like to ask about the optimum place to look immediately before executing the putt and at impact. He says, I see some pros looking at the ball for an interminable amount of time before they putt. And conversely, I know that it's some golf educators advocate looking at the hole during a putt. All this confuses me. Personally, I found that the best practice for me is to, after I get all set up and take a last look at the hole for at least 4 seconds, then while standing and looking at the hole, I'll begin my takeaway, and while taking away the club head back, I will swivel my head and my eyes back to the ball. It seems that swiveling my head and eyes to the ball in synchronization with my shoulder turn results in more impact one-piece movement. It works for him. But
Ron, was that a question?
That's an explanation.
Ron, it sounds suspiciously like what I call flow control. I teach a method for my students where upon examining the break, coming into the ball, and setting the putter online, once we've established our aim point, I like to have my eyes trace the line of the putt, including the break, to the target in relative slow motion and then back. As my eyes reach the ball and putter head, my putter naturally starts back. This eliminates what I refer to as stinking thinking. If you're thinking about looking at the ball, you've already overthought the process. I like to have my students unlock their subconscious. You'll never see me take a practice stroke or waggle. My process is subconscious, and I take my waggle and I compute speed and distance with my eyes. My subconscious knows how much enthusiasm is required to make putts of any distance. So the process you're using, Ron, I believe is a great one. I would suggest that you not overcomplicate it by wondering where to look at the ball. No stinking thinking involved in the putting process.
I also love the fact that you're using the word enthusiasm for how you...
Well, I'd rather not have any effort involved.
Right, right.
I also don't call what I teach drills or practice. We talk about experience and re-experiencing.
Interesting.
Let's not set ourselves up for failure. Let's set ourselves up for success.
Yeah. It's amazing how many times I've talked to professional athletes, whether they be golf or otherwise. And when I talk about the mental game with them, they're like, there is no failure. Why? You know, that's an amateur thing, the mental game, because you're concerned about failure. Well, when you're at this level, there is no chance for failure. You never even, failure never equates in any part of your thought process.
And that's why earlier I had said to you that we let's play to our ability and let's not put ourselves in a position of thinking that we can hit 300-yard drives. Leave that for the guys on tour.
Yeah.
Play to your ability. And when you come to the conclusion that, yes, you only hit it 240, you're less likely to be disappointed in the outcome of your shot. If you know that you hit right to left or left to right, set up on the tee for that shot. If you know that your tendency is to come up short, put one more club in your hand and swing easy. Don't try to muscle a shorter club and make it go further. But that's not putting. Let's get back to putting.
Yeah, let's get back to putting, because the last question here from Dana Olson in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Love the email address. Packer Dana. What do you think? Football fan? I have a line.
Hopefully Dana's a golf fan. He's got a little bit longer to wait before he can play up there in La Crosse.
Yeah, exactly. I have a line drawing on my ball. The trouble is I'll figure out what my line is and I'll line up my ball, line up from behind, and then step up and address my ball. Now, when I'm standing by the ball, it looks as if my line is wrong. Then I'll second-guess myself and putt from what I think looks like the right one at address. Sometimes it just goes in, and sometimes it doesn't. Which line should I trust, the line from behind my ball or the one I see at address? Or should I even draw a line on the ball?
Dana, absolutely one of my favorite questions. And I'll give you my personal situation. I have a pretty strong astigmatism. I'm not a young guy. I'm 56 years old, so my eyes don't work like they used to either. I cannot put a lined ball down at arm's length without it being about 5 degrees right of target. So my putting routine has me turn the ball completely down, no logo, no line. I use the lines on my Rife putter for alignment. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm looking at. I'm not looking at the ball for a through line. I'm actually looking ahead for my spot that I'm putting through, and I use the alignment aids on my putter to square myself up. So if I could suggest anything, if you're confused about it, get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let that stinking thinking get in the way of your success.
Excellent. Excellent. So pick a spot that you're aiming to, just a foot, 18 inches in front of the ball, and use the lineman on your putter and go towards that.
Trust it. If you've practiced your putting and you have a reasonable expectation that what you see for break and line is correct, and you've sighted in the speed of the surface today, you'll have a very good chance of success, because your subconscious knows how much enthusiasm is required and knows exactly where to aim the ball.
So let's talk about golf balls for a minute. Does a $45 golf ball putt better than a lesser ball?
I am playing the new eco-friendly Earth ball from Dixon Golf. Mm-hmm. And I play it for a number of reasons, but most importantly, it has a 392 dimple pattern. It's a very high-quality ball. And I tell all my students when they come to me that I'd like them to dedicate 24 golf balls to their practice putting bag. And I ask them to practice with what they play. There's no gain in practicing with shag bag full of cut, scuffed golf balls, or worse yet, with a range ball for putting. Brand new, pristine, clean balls putt better than used, scuffed, and or range balls. There's a lot to be said for the higher quality golf balls in terms of sound and feel. So many of my students come to me and they have preferences for a putter or a golf ball or both, and they talk about feel in a golf ball when in actual fact what they've quantified is more sound than feel.
It's an interesting point.
I have a stable of golf professionals who I work with on tour who putt with nothing but Pro V1. And depending on the putter used, if they're using an insert face putter, they have often gravitated to a harder ball like Pro V1X because they felt the sound, quantified as feel, was too soft with the insert face.
Mm-hmm.
So the ball and putter combination are important. For me, I'm looking for a ball that has an appropriate number of dimples, is in pristine condition, and rolls true. Now, lower quality balls can tend to have some irregularities, and we get into spinning and balancing golf balls of that nature so that we can mark them for the appropriate axis to putt, whereas the higher quality balls, for the most part, are very true in their manufacture. And this is what you're paying for. As much as you're paying for material, you're paying for quality of manufacture so that you know the ball is balanced.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk to you about the Dixon Earth golf ball for a moment. You said a word that I've not heard associated with a golf ball a minute ago. You said eco-friendly.
Oh, yeah.
Talk to
we're,
me.
We're green.
No, I'm green.
My significant other is a wildlife biologist, and by osmosis over the years, she has trained me to go green. Mm-hmm. And when I first saw the Dixon Earth golf ball, it was like a light coming on. The number of golf balls lost and put out of play each year for whatever reason is in the millions.
I saw an advertisement on TV recently. It was for an insurance company, and they said there's 1 billion golf balls lost each year.
Yes.
That's an amazing.
And I know the golf ball manufacturers say if you lose them, we'll make more.
Yeah, that's an amazing amount of waste.
It is. And Dixon actually pay golfers $1 a ball to recycle their product.
What?
They give you a credit of $1 a ball direct through their recycle centers at retail in green grass to recycle the ball and purchase more of the Dixon Earth Ball. It's revolutionary. It's never been done in our industry before. And
you know, how do they do, like, if you've scuffed the ball, if it's gotten enough play, but you still possess the ball, you can send it back to them and they'll give you credit to buy a new ball?
You can walk into the golf shop that you bought it and put it in their little recycle center and get $1 off your next purchase right there. You don't have to send it back to Dixon, though you can.
Dollar off the box or your next ball? I mean, is it $1 per ball or $1?
It's $1 per ball to a maximum $12 per dozen.
No kidding. That's phenomenal.
The ball retails at $39.95. So take $12 off that for recycle credit, and you've got a golf ball that is, oh my God, good. Let's forget about it being green. And let's talk about performance, because
the Dixon
folks have absolutely done themselves proud. You know, PGA Tour Partners just did a ball test and came back with what I think is one of the highest acceptance ratings. They got a 92% approval rating back through their member testers.
From the PGA Tour Partners.
Last month. Yes. And that test will appear in their April publication, but it's already, shall we say, public knowledge as it's been mentioned on their website. But 92% approval.
Wow. And so on a normal, and I don't know what to compare that to, let's take the Bridgestone V330. Do they have a high rating like that, or the Nike One Tour? Or, I mean, these are expensive golf balls I'm talking about. You mentioned it's at $40 a box. These are more than that. But do they have that kind of high rating as well?
I have not followed the Tour Partners testing. I can tell you that in the testing of the Dixon ball, the comparisons came back with members talking about having played Pro V1, having played the Callaway three-piece ball, that they were happy with it or happier. And to say that for what is a new and unique offering in the golf ball world is pretty strong testament.
That's amazing. Plus, you get that money back if you return the balls. But let's talk about the manufacturing of that ball, environmentally friendly. Are they using recyclable products to create the ball as well?
No, that's one of the misnomers I think they have to, a little bit of a hurdle in education that they have to get over. The balls are made from 100% virgin materials, proprietary, as they call it, polymers that give them a compatibility between cover and core so that they can actually grind up the ball when it's returned for recycle. And they sell the after product, the tailings, if you will, from that grind to injection molding, rotomolding manufacturers who use polymer and can use this as further fill in their process. So the carbon footprint, if you will, of Dixon golf balls is very small. Wow. Because not only do they talk the talk, they walk the walk. The company in its own right don't even send invoices by mail to their customers. Everything's done electronically. It's remarkable.
That's fabulous. Well, I hope to hear more about Dixon Earth golf balls. I hope that everyone starts investigating on their own. Hopefully, we'll have more to talk about them, because I think that going green on your golf ball, because it is something that we do lose, and why not if it's going to be...
No.
I do. I lose golf balls. I have lost golf balls, and I like playing new golf balls too, but I don't like. Well, anyway, hopefully we'll get to hear more about Dixon Earth golf balls in the future. I'm going to do a lot more investigation on it because if it's got a green, listen, I have a hybrid car. I hit a hybrid golf club. I even own a hybrid dog. So,
got you beat. Yeah. Got you beat. I've got two hybrids.
Dogs?
Dogs.
Or clubs?
No, well, yeah, I actually have two hybrids in my bag, and I have two hybrid dogs.
You win.
I drove a hybrid car for the first time during the PGA show. I had a Toyota Prius, and I got to say, I'm a believer.
Well, anyway, the green golf ball, the Dixon Earth environmentally friendly green golf ball. Boy, we're going to make sure everyone hears a lot about that. I'm all
the golf,
for it.
The golf press are all over this since its unofficial rollout in July of 2008. The Dixon Earth golf ball has been mentioned in the golf press all over the world.
Fabulous. Well, we wish them all the luck in the world. Hey, I want to thank you so much for your time. We've gone over what we usually do. I don't think the listeners are complaining because you had a lot of phenomenal and valuable content, and that's what we're all about here. Thanks so much, Glenn Coombe, the putting doctor with the money-back guarantee, putting experience. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks so much, buddy.
Thanks, Fred.
Since I've done this interview with Glenn, Dixon Earth has sent me a box to try for myself. Now, remember that story I shared a couple episodes ago about almost getting the hole-in-one? That was with the Dixon Earth golf ball. I've got to tell you, I really like this ball a lot. How many ways can I brag about my round with that ball? It's the second round I've played since December, and I've not been practicing. Yet it was the best score I've ever posted at Rooster Run. Plus, it was a windy day. I hit more greens, my putting was better, and the ball was traveling farther. I'm telling you, it's a good ball. You know, they tell me it's tournament quality. I don't know what that means because I don't play tournaments. I liked the ball. Now, don't let me discount the eco-friendly impact. I really think that's important, but it's a bonus. You've been with me as I've been through the Titleist NXT and the NXT Tour phase, then my Bridgestone E6. There's even been a time when I played a Pro V1. I have a tough time playing with a ball that stands for provisional. Pro V1, provisional. You've not figured that out? I don't know why they do that. But I'm here to say the Dixon Earth ball is my ball of choice right now, and I want to get them in your hands too. It's a new ball. That's why you haven't heard about it, and so I'm really excited to be the first one to tell you. I've spoken to the folks at Dixon Earth Golf Balls, and they also want you to try their balls. They have agreed to put the Golf Smarter logo on the balls and provide 5 dozen Dixon Earth golf balls to give away. So, we'll have a drawing, and 5 winners will each receive 1 box of a dozen balls. Go to golfsmarter.com and click on the contest tab to enter and win a box of Dixon Earth golf balls. Get your entry in early, because we're only going to do this for a few weeks to increase your chances of winning. Deadline is April 10, 2009. Last time out, I mentioned a special mini-episode to announce some news and changes that are coming to Golf Smarter. Things here are changing every day, so we're really not ready to make that announcement yet. I thought I was, and every day something changed, and I keep wanting to make this announcement because I don't want to keep you in the dark, but I promise it is coming. Hopefully, providing you with more chances to check out the Dixon Earth golf balls will be part of the announcement, so please be patient with me, hang tight, and keep listening. You know how much I appreciate your continued support. And to show that appreciation, we are still urging you to enter to win a set of clubs from One Iron Golf. Not only have I received a tremendous amount of email with your thoughts about the conversation with David Lake, but I'm also receiving reports from you that without winning, you've contacted One Iron Golf to purchase a set for yourself. Are the major manufacturers really duping us into believing that they have a new and better design each year, especially when they have stringent restrictions on their design parameters? David made a great case for his product, so if you haven't heard it yet, check out the conversation with David Lake of One Iron Golf and enter to win a set at golfsmarter.com. It's a 3-through pitching wedge. And while you're on that page, click on the One Iron Golf banner to see their webpage and do your own research. Aye, we close today's long St. Patty's Day show with an appropriate quote on putting mulligans. How's this one? Nonchalant putts count the same as chalant putts. Up next, if it's not that special announcement, is TPI-certified fitness instructor and former professional football player, Corey Taylor. Would love to hear your comments, quotes, suggestions, and questions. To send me an email, click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.